Welcome to the very first Volcano podcast. We're going to be doing these monthly on different themes, and this month we're focusing on the foreign investment myth. I'm joined here by Isabel, Ivan, my name is Listen, and we're recording on the ancestral occupied territories of the Kwantlen and Kaitse peoples. Specifically, we're parked outside the Anita Place tent city in Ivan's van.
Today, this inaugural podcast is reproducing a panel presentation that Alliance Against Displacement organized in March 2018, about the foreign investment myth and its role in obscuring the housing crisis in British Columbia and redirecting the political crisis away from a problem of capitalism and colonialism and Canadian property forms. And to a politics of Canadian nationalism and anti-Chinese racism. We held this panel it was the second panel that we organized about the foreign investment myth. And this time we organized it in a context where the provincial government, the local government in British Columbia, where we live, has picked up and emphasized a mythology of the housing crisis being caused by foreign investors or foreign buyers, and increasing a tax or border tariff on those buyers, and spinning a story that that this unfair foreign intervention is what is responsible for the housing crisis here. Since we talked about it the first time, the foreign investment myth has become a mainstream explanation for the housing crisis. So we felt that we had to address it as part of our regular campaign work. And the timing happened because in February, a group, a new coalition called themselves the Affordability Action Hub, organized a protest in Vancouver that was themed as being opposing foreign investment and calling for greater government action against foreign buyers and against things that they called like money laundering schemes and other unfair and illegal or secretive financial operations around real estate investment. We organized a counter rally against their protest in order to clearly show that anti-foreign buyer rhetoric is not part of a housing justice movement, and we organized this panel in March as part of this, as like a follow-up to that counter rally. So today we didn't manage to record that that panel, so we're doing the better thing, which is to have our first podcast be each of the three of us giving a summary of what we talked about at our panel, and then asking questions in a conversation and to further elaborate some of that stuff.
So my talk was called Pacific Nativism and the Safeguarding of Western Liberalism. While we were talking about the foreign investment myth in BC and specifically the Lower Mainland, it occurred to me eventually that there's a lot of anti-mainlander sentiment in Hong Kong as well. And so for the panel, I wanted to draw some connections and to investigate why it is that in Vancouver and in Hong Kong as well, individual mainlanders are being scapegoated for different sorts of economic and cultural problems and are being the targets of people's anxieties around the stability of their societies and their access to resources. So in my talk, I firstly talked about the historical intertwinement of Hong Kong and China and their economies. The reason I started with that is because I find that in Hong Kong, localism, which is what nativists call themselves there, localists. So localists in Hong Kong, they deny the interdependence of Hong Kong and China's economies, but at the same time, completely uncritically embrace the fruits of that interdependence. So they're not anti-capitalist at all. And so starting with this brief history, I talked about how Hong Kong became part of the British Empire because of imperialism, specifically the Opium Wars. And in terms of Hong Kong's economic history in the past, say, 70 years, in the 50s, refugees from mainland China provided a cheap source of labor to fuel the city's rapid industrialization. And then in the 70s and 80s, Hong Kong manufacturers started moving to the mainland, where labor was cheaper, and the Communist Party had started the first special economic zone in Shenzhen, which shares a border with Hong Kong. So if you're looking at the migration of mainlanders to Hong Kong, and how they've served as a source of cheap labor in Hong Kong and then also back in China, these kind of economic movements point to the interdependence and also form the conditions within which Hong Kong became a heavily financialized economy, a sort of administrative gateway to the mainland. So for localists in Hong Kong to completely deny any kind of politics that would yoke their liberation to mainlanders, say working class mainlanders on the other side of the border, to me is ridiculous if we're looking at where Hong Kong's wealth comes from and how it's dependent on capital being able to flow across the border with mainland China. And so Hong Kong's hyper-capitalist, like, laissez-faire economy is itself strife with class conflict within Hong Kong. There's one of the highest rates of millionaires per capita, and yet a fifth of the population is living below the poverty line. And so in my talk, I argued that this scapegoating of individual mainlanders, this encouragement of xenophobia, serves to externalize the conflicts that exist within Hong Kong between different classes. And so, similar to how localists or nativists in Vancouver project all sorts of conflicts onto outsiders, outside mainlanders, in Hong Kong, I think the same thing is going on. And so in Hong Kong, there's this kind of aura of criminality and foreignness projected onto mainlanders. One chief way that happens is by redrafting boundaries around race. So you find a lot of Hong Kongers now don't describe themselves as Chinese anymore, in an effort to replace ways of belonging and identification, like language, culture, shared history, with borders and civic or national belonging. So in order to tie that more to nativism in BC, I also talked about how for Hong Kong, as well as Canada and the United States and us other nations that are either Western liberal nations or places like Hong Kong that have been heavily influenced by Western liberalism, China represents this kind of illiberal other, this sort of foil to Western liberal cultural institutions and values. Isabel was the second speaker on the panel. She spoke about two things: the roots of progressive Canadian nationalism in the NDP and labor movement, and the current-day provincial NDP's use of the foreign investment panic to cover their progressive brand of austerity politics.
Social democracy in Canada has always relied on the imperialist domination of the global south. This is where Canada has extracted its wealth, and then that prosperity has contributed to the relative power of the Canadian working class. This wealth has been accumulated both through imperialism of the global south, and I should also mention colonialism here at home. We can kind of see the way that in the history of social democracy in Canada and in BC, this reality has pushed the NDP towards a politics of assimilationist multiculturalism and white settler nationalism. And in my talk, I gave some examples of these kinds of politics. J.S. Woodsworth, who was really a eugenicist in his racial politics, as well as the Waffle, which was a revolutionary contingent of the NDP in the 60s and 70s, whose main politics was the idea that Canada is being oppressed by the United States, and that the NDP and Social Democrats in Canada need to kind of push back and fight for their own nationalist liberation from the United States. Looking at social democracy, I think ultimately I argued that it emerged at a specific historical moment, under a specific set of circumstances. It became the dominant political form precisely to appease the then-powerful working class, and as well as undermine communism both at home and abroad. And this was possible only because of the wealth that was accumulated, like I said, through imperialist and colonial domination. So in leftist movements today, we see this kind of nostalgia for this moment of social democracy, a desire to go back. And I think that this is not really possible because we've seen this shift since the 1970s, this new international division of labor, wherein the global south has really been set up as a kind of production center and site for resource extraction for the G7 countries like Canada. So we've seen the hyper-exploitation of workers in the global south, and we've also seen the disempowerment of the Canadian working class. So in this context, today, social democracy is no longer the pragmatic solution to poverty and inequality. If it ever was, it's just no longer possible. I think we can think about so-called progressive parties, social democratic parties like the NDP, as actually functioning to consolidate the austerity regimes established by previous governments. And this is something that we've seen with the election of progressive governments after kind of conservative or neoliberal parties as well in other places. Trudeau after Harper, for example, arguably Obama after Bush, as well as earlier generations, the NDP third way government after the Social Credit Restraint Program in the US, Clinton after Reagan and Bush Senior. Like I said, in all of this, the role of the so-called progressive governments is not to save social democracy. The welfare state isn't being revived. It's being destroyed beyond repair. It's really social democracy becomes more of a fantasy than anything else. And in the case of the BC NDP, what the party is doing to distract people from the fact that social democracy is a kind of empty dream is they're relying on the foreign investment myth.
Ivan was the last speaker on the panel. He spoke about why working-class Canadians value the home and what anti-capitalists should do as people feel denied that home.
So the historical problem that I called settler nationalism, I think, begins in with the home as an avatar or a powerful symbol of what it is to belong in Canadian society. And there's two components to this settler social belonging around the home. One of them is cultural and the other is economic. The cultural framework is that the home is the place of, like historically in Western Canada in particular, the home was the place of imperial belonging. And that cultural significance of the home was something that appealed to settlers who felt denied this home in Britain, where it was nearly the exclusive property of the bourgeoisie and of kind of upper middle class families. The other economy of the home, besides that cultural economy, was an economic economy. The home, particularly at this early days, was less so because homes and property had not developed the currency of investment that it did in later years. That was really a product of the post-war period. But in the post-war, the home became a site, a kind of unique site of working class investment. But working class people who were experiencing an economic boom and massive growth in their wages and standards of living, particularly the white working class in Western Canada, they didn't play the stock market or invest in kind of dramatic capitalist investment schemes. The cultural and economic story was that working class people's investment was primarily in the home. That working class people could buy property and they could buy their house and they could either pass that on to their children or they could cash it in and use it towards their retirement. But the home was the enduring economic investment that was supposed to allow working class people stability beyond their immediate wages. And I think that that's become really quickly a point of nostalgia, that people, working class people, want to recover that point of investment as the thing that would promise them security, because nothing has replaced it. It's not that, like, now there's other things working class people can invest in to guarantee their retirement and their children's inheritances. It's just that people have nothing now. And that the nostalgia for that period, which was not a long-term project, it was a very recent cultural economic project that was just the result of the like massive boom in the post-war years, but was the like wages of being a North American white working class man was being able to possess this home as an investment. That nostalgia has become a point of a resentment. And a resentment that is communicating or is accessible through an anti-Asian racism. So the NDP, the progressive Labour Party in British Columbia, has oriented towards this resentment as a political opportunity. This focus that they've picked up has naturalized Canadian capitalism, treating it as inherently fair and right, and treats Asian investment as criminal or suspect or wily, and seeks to cut it off in order to protect and restore the challenge to the Canadian economic order.
Let's have a musical break before we come back to unpacking the foreign investment myth. Here is Landlord by Josh White.
Paint peeling off my wall, dirt piling in the hall, ice on the pipes but no steam at all. Landlord, landlord, that low down rotten good for nothing. He says, I'm gonna raise your rent one day, kick you out if you can't pay. Yes, you and the doggone OPA. Landlord, landlord, that low down rotten good for nothing. He's against public housing, he can't stand the fuss we're rousing. We'll take care of him later with the rat exterminator. Pay him a bonus and give him grease for the right to sign a lease. You can have dogs, but kids must cease. Landlord, landlord, that low-down rotten good for nothing. Plaster fell on my grandma's head, it's what that dirty landlord said. Why a kicking fella, hell, she ain't dead. Landlord, landlord, that disinfecting, rent collecting. Listen to that fake whine, fully rented, says a sign. He really think that war is fine. Landlord, landlord, that low down rotten good for nothing. Mm. He's against slum clearance, government interference. He's a slimy old reptilian worth a cool 11 million. Come on, neighbors, let's get wise. We can lick these greedy guys. All you gotta do is organize. Landlord, landlord, that low-down, rotten, good-for-nothing, evil-speaking, profit-seeking, mercenary, reactionary, landlord, 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 landlord.
I have a couple of questions.
Oh.
Listen, I wanted you to tell the story of people selling baby formula, and the way that the Chinese localists or the Hong Kong localists are telling this story as though this is like some kind of danger. Anyway, I'm gonna do a terrible job of paraphrasing what I want you to talk about. But I wonder about that.
Yeah, totally. So localists in Hong Kong, one of their chief rallying points and concerns is the presence of what they call parallel traders. So parallel traders are mainland Chinese people who live in Shenzhen, and so are given, I think Shenzheners are allowed multiple entry visas, they were previously allowed multiple entry visas that lasted for 1 year, but those were restricted to once a week visits in 2015, in part due to anti-mainlander localist sentiment in Hong Kong. So Shenzheners are allowed to come to Hong Kong once a week if they have these visas. And these parallel traders are people who come over the border to Hong Kong where products are, due to regulation, safer and more trusted. So they'll buy milk powder, infant formula. I think the maximum per person is maybe 1.6 kilograms. And then they bring it over the border to sell it in China, where there was, that crisis of milk powder poisoning babies however many years ago. So one, there's a perception that products are safer.
Sounds like a scary crisis.
Yeah, totally.
So therefore a potent metaphor.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. If your livelihood is purchasing a kilo and a half of milk powder once a week in Hong Kong and selling it in Shenzhen, you're probably not the richest of the rich. These by and large aren't rich tourists, but they've become this emblem of mainlanders sucking resources from Hong Kong. A local paper portrayed mainlanders as locusts hovering over the city.
Because of the baby formula
thing? Well, there's the baby formula thing. There's also concern about what they call anchor babies. So pregnant mainlanders coming and giving birth in Hong Kong, which then entitles those children to access public schools in Hong Kong. Mm. So it's pretty run-of-the-mill xenophobia where foreigners are seen as flooding into a nation and taking all the resources that rightfully belong to the locals.
It sounds like some of those discourses are similar to American, anti-alien stories.
Yeah, totally. Totally. And there was, I think I mentioned in the talk, the incident of there was a 12-year-old boy who had been born in the mainland. I think his parents abandoned him, and so he ended up moving to Hong Kong to live with his grandma, but he was undocumented, so he had never gone to school or seen a doctor. But his case became publicly known, I think maybe in 2012 or 2015, maybe. And localists actually went through the trouble of creating public rallies and demonstrations to ensure that this 12-year-old boy would be deported, because the narrative was that if they let this one 12-year-old boy from the mainland, who was born in the mainland, stay in Hong Kong, then mainlanders will just completely flood into the city and take everybody's resources. But I think one of the central problems is that it creates this Hong Kong versus Chinese mainland dichotomy, within which, for example, white people who are in Hong Kong because of colonization and are inheritors of power and money because of that British colonial legacy, there's no attention towards them as not belonging in Hong Kong. There's also racialized migrants, domestic workers, refugees who aren't Chinese or white, whose concerns are completely left out of the localists' worldview. And so, similar to the kind of nostalgia that you two are describing in BC, there's this nostalgia for British colonization amongst localists, so they'll actually wave the flag, Hong Kong's British colonial flag, at demonstrations. Because like the British Empire is constructed as the foil to the Chinese state. So it's this odd sort of tacit embrace or explicit embrace of British colonization for the purpose of like rejecting China.
Do you think that it's like a real nostalgia? Like, I mean, nostalgia can be a real feeling. Is it like a real political program? Are they actually advocating for like
a return to Britain?
Be like a British protector?
There are some people who are advocating for Hong Kong to be part of Britain again.
But they're an island, we're an island.
take us back. We miss you. Yeah. No, I think it's more of a... I think, so in order for Hong Kongers to no longer identify as Chinese, you have to decide what Hong Kongerness is. And I think the answer has been that Hong Kong's cultural identity is a mixture of like traditional Chinese pre-communist China values and British colonization. So there's this embrace of this kind of, East meets West sort of hybrid, where Hong Kong is China before the communists, and all these great gifts from the British, like laissez-faire capitalism.
Oh, I just wanted to mention, I just recently read an article in the newspaper about a petition started by a Richmond resident about cracking down, asking Ottawa to crack down on birth tourism.
Yeah.
Specifically people coming from China and giving birth in the Richmond General Hospital. I just think there are so many parallels between the kind of localism that you're describing in Hong Kong, and the kind of settler nationalism, white settler nationalism that we see here, the kind of entitlement to, when people say things like Canada is a wealthy country or Vancouver is a wealthy city, and this being kind of the backbone of any leftist argument for like social programs or housing or anything like this is like a kind of entitlement to the wealth within national borders at the exclusion of people from China or elsewhere. That's just what I wanted to say. Clear parallels.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking of something that you said, Isabel, you're talking about austerity, like the progressive austerity of the BC NDP, and in the context of this anti-foreign buyer logic stuff. And it occurred to me that this is an interesting turn, because austerity has always been, austerity in this like neoliberal period beginning in the 1980s is this like, here's when austerity started to take apart the welfare state. It's always been a component of encouraging foreign investment, like because it's lowering taxes in order to draw global companies to Canadian cities as bases for their operations. Like those tax cuts have always been a part of it, and one of the first neoliberal measures passed by the federal government of Canada was to change the, it was called the Foreign Investment Review Board. He changed it to Investment Canada. Anyway, at the same time that they began cutting social programs. I just wanted, what do you think how is the austerity logic being played alongside this like anti-investment, like anti-foreign buyer thing?
I think one of the reasons why the foreign investment myth is so powerful and has been taken up by the left is because it masquerades as a turn away from neoliberalism. Mm-hmm. I think there's a kind of populist element, both with the foreign investment myth here, as well as Trump's tariffs that you referred to, where people's understanding of neoliberalism and the way that we have seen neoliberalism operate is free flow of capital over borders, right? So, like, we can think back to the anti-globalization movement, kind of efforts to push back against that neoliberal policy in order to, like, rescue social democracy or towards revolution. But I think that we need to understand neoliberalism as a tactic for Western imperialist domination, and here in Canada, the domination of the colonial state and the capitalist class over Indigenous, non-citizen, and working class people. So neoliberalism is a tactic for that kind of domination. It's not a totality. It's really a complex constellation of practices and policies and ideologies. Like, fiscal austerity is one of them, but privatization, deregulation, free trade, government stabilization is a whole set of things. But the thing with neoliberalism is that it's only ever worked for the benefit of Western imperialist nations, financializing their economies and locating production in the global south. So now that these imperialist powers like Canada are facing some degree of competition from China, for example, they're backtracking and introducing these one-way tariffs, like the foreign buyer's tax. So I think neoliberalism, again, it's not a totality, it's a tactic that can be adjusted to maintain power.
And like you said, neoliberalism has only worked for imperialist countries, or like the countries that have financialized and then sent production, like industrial production elsewhere, to pursue low wages and poor working conditions and no environmental restrictions and all of these things that then destroy nations in the global south. But it's important, I think, to consider that neoliberalism only works for some people in imperialist countries. Mm-hmm. And for most people, it's been increasing, like, an internal division of, like, straight up colonized people, that colonized people within Canada live in another country, not an imperialist country. They live under an imperialist country, under an imperialist order, and neoliberalism has totally secured that. But I guess I was also wondering about this, something you said made me, you said that Canadian working class has had a relative power, and that, and so it's relative to working class people in other parts of the world. And the Canadian working class is like, of course, is like a working class that experiences the cultural power of being Canadian. So it excludes many racialized working class people and, informal and low wage and workers and unemployed people who are not part of this power. But classically, Marxists have referred to that group that has relative power as a working class, that has like that lives more like a petty bourgeoisie than a proletarian, as an aristocracy of labor. Do you think that this arrangement is changing? What this, like, is there's like a nostalgic element for that like that labor aristocracy amongst working class people now?
I think that is precisely what the foreign investment myth is based on.
Yes,
Ivan, I agree with that. I think this kind of nostalgia is precisely for the single detached house, mm-hmm. a yard, a picket fence. How can we understand that as anything but a kind of aristocratic lifestyle? Yeah, I think that maybe our understanding of who the working class is stretched and confused and depoliticized. And I mean, people talk about, what is it, that there's the middle class is disappearing. Mm. So if we're talking about a disappearing middle class, maybe we're talking about like the fear of losing this aristocracy that you're referring to, is that the same thing as the disappearing middle class, the same thing as the disappearing aristocracy of labor?
I think it is. I mean, the middle class is never, it doesn't mean anything. It's garbage language that is like, it's like pop language to talk about class organization. Because the middle class is, in like cultural read in Canada, the middle class is those who are not poor and not rich. And poor means like super poor, and rich means super rich. So the middle class is this sprawling group that includes practically everybody, and has no analytical categorical value. Like, it adds nothing to our, it's not a useful category for analysis. But if we think about class in terms of relationship to production, where a working class person is compelled to sell their labor because they have nothing else to sell, a capitalist buys labor power as a commodity, or a bourgeoisie buys labor power as a commodity and invests it as capital into a circuit of production. And I mean, what Marx called the petty bourgeoisie, or this is maybe the middle class, is an administrative layer or a small business distributive layer, and neither a great owner of production nor subordinated to selling labor power. Or they're administering ideologies or other functions of the dominant society. But yeah, I guess like we do have to be clear about what we mean by working class, but like the aristocracy of labor is part of the working class. They're just a part that has, like, they're still, they don't have like great security actually. The great security that they had before was this investment in a home. And I think that investing in a condo does not carry the same, neither economic security nor cultural power, mm-hmm. as having a single detached home. Should we bemoan? I mean, the thing it feels a bit weird about being like, well, fuck the aristocracy of labor, it's so great that it's gone, is that like it represents a loss of security and well-being for a great amount of working class people in this country. And it's not going to be replaced with something that's like, it's not going to be replaced with like a better global order. It's going to be replaced with an increasing concentration of wealth and power in the hands of even fewer. Mm-hmm. And it seems like this kind of populist move to like divert that into like the Asians are coming is like, in order to circumvent that from being a crisis that directly affects capital. Like, mm-hmm. that stops that from being like anger at those who are concentrating wealth and power in their hands,
yeah.
at the exclusion of this, like the broadening exclusion of that group. It should present political opportunities for us to be like, this whole thing is broken.
The groups that activist groups, like Affordability Action Hub, if we can call them activists, that promote, these groups that promote the foreign investment myth, they're also focused almost exclusively on home ownership. So when they talk about homeless people, it's in passing if they talk about homeless people at all. So I think, I don't know, this kind of, it's a limited politics.
I think they use homeless people as a metaphor. Yeah. Like, I think they use homeless people, like the desperation and dislocation that homeless people represent, they use that as a metaphor for how they feel about not being able to buy a detached home in Vancouver. Like, yeah. Like, I feel like that homeless person looks. It's like they refer to their suffering through the mobilization of homeless people's actual danger, the danger that they experience.
And the extent of their political project is not to house everybody who needs a home in this province, but it's to restore for a small group of people the possibility of ownership, of home ownership.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we could be criticized as saying that we're not taking advantage of the crisis that these people are experiencing to broaden the coalition, like possible coalitions for action against like capitalist crisis around housing. These are potential, these like petty bourgeois or members of labor aristocracy who feel denied their home are potential some might say could be potential allies in this moment, even if that alliance doesn't continue.
In order for us to ally with them, first we need to completely interrupt the foreign investment myth, because it perpetuates racism and white settler nationalism. So perhaps this project that we're engaging in right now is the first step to a future alliance with these people. Yeah.
Like, I feel like the foreign investment myth locates the problems of colonialism and capitalism outside of settler Canadian society. Yeah. It just feels so spatial to me. It's the diagnosing the problem as outside, being forced in. Like that Halt guy even described, not even the actions of the Chinese state, but the presence of a Chinese language real estate advertisement as colonization, as Chinese colonization of settler Canada. It just doesn't.
I've seen another one of those guys refer to a white member of Halt saying that he wants to be put onto he should be put onto a new Indian reserve.
Oh my god. That's ridiculous. People in Hong Kong also completely misuse the word colonization and invasion. But yeah, in order to build a coalition, you have to agree on where the location of the issue is.
I think that the opportunity that's presented is like the opportunity of the collapse of this moment, the collapse of the post-war massive aristocracy of labor that characterized like white working class people's experience in large parts in Western Canada. I think the collapse of that is an opportunity actually for people to understand themselves as working class again. Like it's an opportunity like that. And that what we should do with that is not try to resuscitate that nostalgia for the home, which is it's like an operating base for imperialist ideology and for people to identify themselves with empire. Like to identify yourself, that home, that it is a powerful thing that it ties, like it binds working class people to like settler colonialism in Canada. It like invests them symbolically and materially in the dispossession of Indigenous people's lands, and not just at a moment of like, I'm buying a house now. It's like a lifetime kind of narrative that binds them into this thing. And I think that the opportunity with that collapse is to push on the perversions, like how this gets in the way of our humanity, and to push for people to understand themselves as sharing a destiny with working class people in China, and to refuse to participate any longer with dispossession of Indigenous people. Like that's the political project, not just like we should all fight together to get a house. Like that's this, like this is misusing what this like demand would be, you know.
I find revolutionary defeatism so inspirational, and whenever I try to describe it to other people, I feel like I can't quite capture what is so powerful about it to me. But I did want to ask you, Ivan, if you can think of any examples, historically or contemporary examples, of how revolutionary defeatism might look in practice.
I mean, I think that what, like, in terms of our fighter on the foreign investment myth, I think that we're doing that thing. Like we're saying, okay, yes, Canada is no longer the undisputed champion of the global economy and the like an aristocracy of labor within the country is no longer purely benefiting from a massive accumulation of wealth from elsewhere. Like the change in that dynamic with the like increase of competition, particularly from China, but not only China, but increase of competition globally. That moment is what is the way that we're interpreting the foreign investment myth. And we're seeing it as, okay, in that context, we should do everything that we can to speed the decline of Canada. Like we should actually, it doesn't mean that we want China to win and invade and take over Canada. We're not, because we are tying our destiny to the struggles of people in like working class and colonized people in China who will fight against the Chinese state in the same way that we need to fight against the Canadian state. I think the proposition of a revolutionary defeatism is to actually take our politics very seriously and to not like hedge our bets and be like, we need what realistically should we be thinking? How do we make things a bit better? Mm-hmm. But it's actually the proposal here is to recognize that we're in a moment of historical transformation. We don't know what pace that's going to take place at, but there's been a long decline since the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. And the destruction, like organized destruction of labor movements to have this global moment arrive like it is now. And this shift, I think that this shift is a time where internationalism has to be back on the table again. Mm-hmm. And there's no way for us to forge international ties if we're at like in a real way that is coordinated and supporting, if we're blocking with Canada against foreign powers. Like the challenge, a revolutionary defeatist challenge is that we actually put a revolutionary project on the table again. And I don't think that we're at the point of like having a totally worked out articulation of what that means. Mm-hmm. But I do think that this is the way that we work it out, by taking on the politics as they develop around us, analyzing them and working out a like program of what to do based on the like commitment to our principles, which is that we do want to collapse a capitalist world system. And our biggest limitations in the last 30 years have been the end of really international collaboration on these questions. Mm-hmm. And an increasing localism, where we think only about what's right in front of us. We misdiagnose the crises going on around us as something that has to do with something like some directly local event. And we don't see these international connections. I think that these the problems of international trade and divisions of wealth and power and imperialism, that they're coming into focus right now. It's interesting to me that some people are saying that some people in the left are saying that now imperialism is too complicated. We can't use the word imperialism anymore. It's not really a thing any longer. I think
who says that?
Well, that whole viewpoint, or whole viewpoint issue.
Oh, yeah.
I think that, and David Harvey said something like this recently too. I think that right now these things are on this like anti-imperialist struggle is on the table in the way that it hasn't been in many years. And it's just, I think it's emerging again. And serious collaboration with working class people in other countries in order to take down our own governments is I think the way that it makes the most sense to me.
Okay, well that ends our very first Volcano podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in, and we hope that you'll listen to the next one next month.
See you next month.
Bye. Say goodbye.
Bye.